Daniel Acker is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where a prison staff is preparing to put Acker to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state responsible for more than a third of all U.S. executions. Execution Watch host Marlo Blue, with criminal defense attorneys Larry Douglas, Mike Gillespie, Jack Lee, and Paige Yannick. Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Linda Huhan. The execution watch for Daniel Acker begins.
Good evening and welcome to the Thursday, September the 27th, 2018 edition of Execution Watch. I want to start off by thanking the staff of KPFT and the Pacifica Network for the live streaming of the Brett Kavanaugh hearings. If you appreciate this kind of coverage, I urge you to pick up the phone right now. Dial 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-KPFT and make your contribution to the Pacifica Network and to KPFT. I know that if you were like me, I was entranced all day. Now, whether you are listening live on one of our FM channels, 90.1 FM Houston, 89.7 Huntsville, or simulcast and archived at kpft.org, thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Marlo Blue, filling in for Ray Hill. As many of you know, Ray is currently in hospice. We wish him a speedy recovery and look forward to his return in October for the next scheduled execution of Juan Segundo. If you are tuning in for Living Arts, usually heard here every Thursday from 6 to 7 p.m., please check back next week when it resumes its regularly scheduled slot. And they are broadcasting live on the HD1 channel, so you can go to kpft.org and listen to tonight's show. We welcome your opinions on social media and beyond to learn more about the death penalty and executions in the state of Texas. Join us on Facebook at Execution Watch or online at executionwatch.org. And please join our mailing list for all the latest updates. Tonight, we stand in vigil as the state of Texas plans to execute Daniel Clayton Acker, sentenced to death for the 2000 kidnapping and murder of a 32-year-old female he was cohabitating with. Joining us in the studio to put this case in perspective is our panel of experts, Larry B. Douglas, Jack Lee, Mike Gillespie, and Paige Yannick. Thank you all so much for joining us tonight. This program is the first and only live electronic vigil where we provide firsthand reports of the Texas death machine in action. We appreciate those of you joining us internationally on the World Wide Web, and we join those of you who stand in vigil on the streets of Texas cities and in front of the death house in Huntsville. Our reporter, Linda Huhan, joins us now live by phone from outside the death house in Huntsville. Linda, thank you for joining us today. Please describe the scene for us.
Well, tonight there's not a lot of people out here protesting. There's only like four of us, and they've gone across the line now, but there is no family is attending this, so I don't know. We don't know if they're still here or if they went back home after their visit today, but they did not come to the execution. There's only the ministers went in with the news media, and that's it.
So they're the only witnesses that we know of. Have they already crossed into the death house?
Yes, they have.
Any word of a stay from your age?
Pardon me?
Any word of a stay from where you stand?
No, Abbott's the only one that can issue a stay at this moment, and I don't expect one from Abbott.
Right. Well, Linda, please let us know when you receive word. Just contact Bob here in the control room, and we'll be standing by for your report.
Thank you very much, Marlo.
Thank you so much. Now, let's go to Mike Gillespie for an analysis of this case. Mike, how did we get here?
Well, we get there by one day in 2000. this man flagged down a police officer and reported that his girlfriend was murdered. He admitted everything he wanted to the police at the scene. He didn't try to hide it. He told them what happened, that his girlfriend jumped out of the car and was now dead. Upon further investigation, they decided that she did not jump out of the car, that he ran her over with his own car. This is troubling to me because I'm not sure anybody knows what really happened. There's two or three theories. The original theory is that while he was driving the car, he choked her and she jumped out and got hit by another car. Then there was a theory. In fact, a witness saw him stop, drag her out of the car and lay her on the ground and drive off. Then there was another theory that he killed her and pushed her out of the car. Nobody knows exactly how she got out of the car. Did she jump? Did he push her? Nobody knows.
Well, what was the cause of death?
The cause of death, according to the indictment, and according to the jury instruction, and according to the argument by the district attorney to the jury, it was death by strangulation and or blunt force trauma. They don't explain if blunt force trauma is a baseball bat or a board or a car, because they don't know. They do now know how serious her injuries are, and the injuries seem to be serious enough to be run over by a car, but they don't know. That issue later on appeal was a big issue we'll talk about before I get done. But the jury found him guilty. He was sentenced to death, and the appeal started. Now, at the first appeal, the state's evidence, the state expert, said there was no sign of being strangled. Well, the indictment said either strangled or blunt force trauma. Technically, that's okay. They can say and or, injunctive, disjunctive English words, but that's okay. But when their expert on the appellate level, on the appeal level, says she wasn't strangled, there's no proof of strangulation, then it must have been blunt force trauma. But the question of how the blunt force trauma happened has never been explained.
So, we have, where was this case actually tried?
It was tried in the county of the occurrence, and the name escapes me right now. Hopkins County. It's and a very small county, Hopkins County.
They, of course, used a coroner there who produced the autopsy that gave this information. What difference would it have made if it had been strangulation and then?
That's interesting.
What's the difference?
I don't think if this was a murder case, it would make a difference, because many times they find a body, they can know who did it, and how he did it is not as relevant as to the fact the body is dead. I just happen to feel that if you're going to escalate a murder case to a capital murder case, there should be some more evidence as to what happened to justify the death penalty.
And this, again, his sentencing was in 2000, is that correct?
That's
Paige, I want to bring you into the conversation at this point, because we were having a very interesting conversation about the sentencing phase of this particular trial.
Well, excuse me. Well, the interesting thing to me about this case is that sentencing could have, if it had been a different defendant or a different fact pattern, or a different time period, much different than we ended up with a capital murder verdict. Once upon a time, prior to 2005, our only option if a jury found a defendant guilty of capital murder was, did they find him to be executable because of future dangerousness and lack of mitigation evidence, or was he not executable? In any event, since September of 2005, we have another option for punishment other than execution. You can find a defendant guilty of capital murder, and the jury can decide to go ahead and give them life without parole. And that's only been an option since 2005. Now, this was not necessarily a case where life without parole had it arisen after 2005 been the issue. But this case arose in 1999. And so the only option once they found him guilty was, do you execute him or not? Now we have the other option of life without parole. And I was researching whether or not the death row population now looked at execution or life without parole. And the most recent figures I was able to find were from July 31st, 2016. And the death row population on July 31st, 2016, was 244. And the population in TDC of those who had been found guilty of capital murder but sentenced to life without parole at the end of July in 2016 was 782. I've tried all day to find current figures on what might happen today, but I just wasn't able to get them out of TDC. But I was asking a peculiar question, and they're doing an execution today, and so I understand their reluctance to talk to me. It appears that we have a death row population now of somewhere in the neighborhood of 292, or at least we had at the end of July. But I'm not going to stand on that figure, and I have not counted, and so I can't even say. In any event, had the facts been different in this case, and I lament the fact that the facts are not different, but had the facts been different, this might have, because of the teeny tiny population of Hopkins County. It's a very small county in East Texas, right off Interstate 30. It's west of Tyler, and anyway, because it's a small county, they might not want to go ahead and try a capital for death, simply because it takes lots of appeals, it takes lots of money, it takes lots of time, it takes lots of attention that small counties don't necessarily focus on. And past the 2005 effective date of the life without parole, maybe Hopkins County could have decided that, yes, they're going to go ahead and find him guilty of capital murder, but they're not going to kill him. Simply because, well, for whatever reason. I can't even speculate. But smaller counties don't want to go through the expense of a capital murder death watch and all the things involved in that. And Hopkins County is a smaller county.
Has the popularity of the death penalty decreased that much, or do you think it's just simply too prohibitive to put up that kind of expense?
I think it's a combination of both. I think that there are some cases where the public at large looks at it and goes, oh, my Lord, oh, my Lord, we can't do this. I mean, this has got to go. And then there are other cases where the population goes, I don't know.
Yeah.
And the option of life without parole is being used more frequently. But the most important thing is that we're not, let's just look at our broadcast in particular. We're not broadcasting executions as frequently as we were 4 years ago. We're doing fewer. So I am thinking that the appellate process and that things involved in capitals are becoming more arduous in order to carry out an execution. I don't know. That's just a gut feeling I have. Mm. I don't have any real facts to back this up. But I think that's what I'm observing right now.
Let's bring Larry Douglas in here right now. Larry, are you looking at these facts? What are you seeing when you look at this case?
Well, the facts are pretty like in most capital murder cases, the facts are pretty difficult to deal with. The facts are pretty terrible. The fact, Marlo, is that Daniel Acker and his girlfriend, by the name of, they called her Marquita, call her Marky George, had a very stormy relationship. And on the day of March 11, 2000, they spent the day together. They'd gone to a rodeo. And at the end of the day, they went by the Bustin' Loose nightclub. Apparently, Acker was pretty jealous because they get into an argument at the nightclub. And she walks away from people see them arguing. She walks away. He sits down at the table with a couple of other young ladies and tell them, I'm going to kill her. I'm going to kill that. He called her a dirty name. I'm going to kill her. One of the ladies says, I knew him, but I just met her that night. And so he said, I'm going to kill her. And then he asked another young man at the club, go over there and tell her I'm going to kill her. And then he tells his sister had gotten he let his sister have a knife. The sister said, well, the knife actually belonged to Marky, so I didn't give him back the knife when he asked for it. But he asked for the knife back. And the sister says, nah, that's, according to the sister's testimony, that's Marky's knife, so I'm not going to give that back to you. And his response to her was like, you know, well, if I want to do something to somebody, I don't need a knife for it. And he had a hatchet in his hand at the time.
In a bar?
Well, he was thrown out of the bar. She asked him for it later. He got thrown out of the bar. The bouncer throws him out of the bar. And when the bouncer throws him out of the bar, he keeps coming back, trying to get inside the bar. He keeps coming back looking for her. Okay. So finally, when the bar closes, then he and his sister who's there, the sister carries him back to his truck that's parked down the street. And that's when he asks for the knife back. And he makes statements to people saying, you know, if she left and she went off by herself, it's going to be okay. But if she went out with a guy, they're both going to have to pay because nobody's going to make me look like a fool. Okay. So he says this on several different occasions. And though then she leaves and he goes to her mother's house looking for her. And her mother says she's not there. So he tells her mother, I'm going to kill her. Mom says, look, that makes no sense. It doesn't make any sense to kill somebody and spend time in the pen over killing somebody. Pen ain't nothing. Pen time ain't nothing to me. That's what he tells her mother. And he keeps looking for her throughout the night. Mm. Well, the next day she arrives back at the trailer where they live. He's already there. And she's delivered back to the trailer by the bouncer from the club. And so Acker asked the bouncer, "Did you guys spend the night together?" He says, "No, I took her to her mother's house." Okay, his name is, bouncer's name is Robert, called Calico McKee. So the bouncer says, "No, I took her to her dad's house." But according to Acker, says, "I knew he was lying, cause, I went by dad's house and she wasn't there." And so he goes back in and he asks her, say, "Did you spend the night with a man?" She says, "What difference does it make?" So he attacks her and she runs out of the house and runs into the neighbor's house and says, "He's going to kill me. He's going to kill me." And the neighbor then, he runs up to the neighbor and the neighbor says, she says, "He's going to kill me. Call the sheriff." The neighbors can't defend her against him. He comes up and grabs her. The neighbor says, throws her over his shoulder and then throws her in his truck. The neighbor says, watching him put her in his truck was kind of like trying to put a cat in a bathtub. So the neighbor then calls the sheriff. Several minutes later, a passerby says that he sees he's traveling about 20 miles an hour. He says, I slowed down about 10 miles an hour. And I see a truck. And there's a man in the driver's seat, but I can't make out that there's anybody else there. So I slowed down really slow. And then I could see from my side view mirror as I passed. I wasn't going to stop. This 65-year-old man says, I wasn't going to stop. And so he says, when he passes by, he says, I saw a man, throw a woman out of the truck into the ground. Well, Acker's truck was found several miles away from the place where Marky George's body was found. And when Acker's has his first encounter with the police, he says that I was in an accident. My girlfriend tried to jump out of my truck. And I tried to stop her, but she was able to jump out and now she's dead. So with that set of facts, he goes to trial and he testifies at trial. And the indictment read, as Paige has already mentioned, that Michael already mentioned that he was charged with having killed her, committed a murder by strangulation and by blunt force trauma. Okay. And that he committed the offense while in the course of attempting to or committing a kidnapping. So we have murder in the course of a kidnapping, capital murder. So the prosecutor sought the death penalty on that set of facts.
If you're just joining us now and expecting to hear Living Arts, you can listen to that program on the HD1 channel. Just go to kpft.org. You're listening at this moment to, HD2 channel on kpft.org. You are listening to a very special edition of Execution Watch, and we are awaiting to find out what has happened to Daniel Acker. The witnesses have already gone into the death house. We are expecting to hear any moment the outcome of this. Let's go back, please, to Mike Gillespie. And Mike, tell us about the defense of this. I mean, how did the defense, how did they do it? What did they say?
Okay, defense of what? In my opinion, this is not a capital murder. It's a strict murder. He shouldn't have been killed. He shouldn't have been charged like this. I don't understand what's going on here. We have had serious serial killers, serious murders. There's nothing about this except a man killed his girlfriend. Larry said the facts right. He killed his girlfriend. It's premeditated murder. He should have gone to jail. He should have gone to jail for a long time. But if you're going to kill people, you better have more definite proof than a murder. Will anybody at this table tell me why this is a kidnapping? Tell
anybody
me.
Anybody have an answer?
Anybody tell me why it's a kidnapping?
Jack?
Go ahead, Larry.
Because he played caveman, threw her over his shoulder, and she ended up dead.
Let's assume he threw over his shoulder and killed her immediately in the car.
But
is that kidnapping, or did he kill her in the car?
Doesn't play out in the testimonial evidence that he threw her over her shoulder and into the truck, a Ford F-350, and it was described as a cat being pushed into a bathtub and then driven off. There's your kidnapping, and then the subsequent death, which, granted, we have to is circumstantial because no one actually saw the killing happen. There's your kidnapping, subsequent circumstantial murder, and you now have capital murder.
Okay, so you tell the jury, if you're the prosecutor, that he kidnapped her and he murdered her. No question he murdered her, and the DA says he kidnapped her. And so they have no...
Well, actually, I would go the other way around, that there is more, that there's an eyewitness saying that there was a kidnapping and that the murder is circumstantial.
Fair enough. With what you said, should a man be executed on circumstantial evidence? Even
it's
though
done
we know he did it?
All the time.
He's found guilty all the time, but if he's murdered all the time, shame on us. You should never execute a person on circumstantial
evidence.
That's
not the way
evidence.
The law is written.
We're not talking about the law here. We're talking about right or wrong. You don't kill people on circumstantial evidence.
I'm here to talk about the law.
Then let's talk about the
I'm
law.
I'm not here to
let's
talk
about
about the ridiculousness of our system.
Then let's talk about the law. Tell me, Larry, what is kidnapping? Excuse me. Tell me, Jack, what is kidnapping?
Kidnapping is taking somebody where they don't want to be.
Okay. Do you know the legal definition of kidnapping?
I don't have the code
well,
in front of
I
me.
I do.
Go ahead.
Kidnapping is abducting somebody.
Okay. Tell
now,
me what did...
Let me ask you a question.
All right. Larry.
Were they asked, was she abducted, or were they told she was kidnapped? Did they make a decision on the abduction? Because let's talk about abduction.
I don't have an extra $8,000 to pull the trial transcript.
Do you know the definition of abduction? Let me tell you, because on... I know because I've looked it up. I'm catching you by surprise. Abduction is secreting somebody. Abduction is hiding somebody so they can't be found. How are you hiding somebody when you throw them in your truck? How is that abduction?
Well, Mike, we talked about this a minute ago.
Well, I know. That's why we're talking about it now.
Abduction is restraining someone either by secreting them or by force or threat.
By force or deadly force. Deadly force, Larry.
Okay. But in this case,
deadly force.
He restrained her movement by force.
Deadly force, not force. The statute says deadly force.
Okay. She was thrown into the truck.
But not by deadly force.
Okay. In the trial, we also, since we have a murder, we do have an autopsy. And the autopsy would have shown, well, the autopsy and the cause, method and means of death calls into play the battle of the experts. You've got the doctors who come in and read the same report as to how she died and what was the cause of death.
I'd like to jump in here right now. Of course, if you are listening to us, you are listening to Execution Watch. Just a reminder that you are listening to KPFT 90.1 FM right here in Houston. But at the moment, let's go to our reporter who is outside of the death house in Huntsville. Linda.
Yes.
Have you had word from the authorities that it's over?
It's over. They've all come back across in the... They're fixing to make a statement about the time he died. I'm not sure exact time, but probably about 5 minutes ago.
And anything that you have to tell us? Any other reactions from what's going on? Or
no, there's a lot of people driving by tonight and being very rude to us and clapping their hands and saying bad things, calling him a child molester, which I don't really understand that because he was not a child molester. And... they've just been really ugly tonight.
That's very unusual. That hasn't been happening. What do you think is the cause of that? Are these locals? Do you know?
They're locals, yeah. They're just locals around here, you know, and they're all mostly in pickup trucks, and I guess just really against trying to save these people.
And could it be that that it's because it's two executions in a row that you're getting more attention and less interest from the actual people who are against the death penalty?
It may be, because we had a lot of people here last night, and it was horrible weather. And we were dripping wet, and we had lots of people. But tonight, nobody's here, really, but the prison show. We've got one lady here from Switzerland, and that's it.
Well, thank you so much, Linda, for being our eyes and ears, and we appreciate it. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Marlo. Good night.
I'd like to remind you, if you are listening to the show, if this is your first time to listen to Execution Watch, if you want to know what all of the hoopla is about, we are telling you what the death machine in Texas is doing, how they are coming about this, why there are so many executions in the state of Texas, and the fabric of our lives that are changing. As Paige mentioned earlier, you know, with a new law that we have of life without parole, things are changing slowly with the execution since 2005, but not fast enough, of course, for Mr. Daniel Aker. And today, Mr. Daniel Aker is now lying in state, I guess, in the chapel, as Jack Lee explained to us yesterday what happens with the body after the actual execution. He was killed, of course, with the cocktail that we talk about. Talk a little bit more about punishment, please, Jack.
Well, before we get into punishment, I want to remind the listeners that after the execution, he is moved into a chapel. He's quickly taken to a chapel so that his family and friends can touch his warm body before it assumes room temperature.
All right. Now, and of course to family or whatever, whoever else is standing with Mr. Daniel Aker, then our sympathies for your loss today. I want to read you all a quote that Ray Hill said last night and open it up a little bit for discussion. In support of a comment that Mike Gillespie made last night, Ray said, and I quote here, "I've been 58 years sober. So I've been in meth houses with crackheads and meth heads, and I know that paranoid circumstances don't look anything like accepted reality. But then, neither does life on death row. What has happened since the conviction is the person has gone to death row, they've dried out, and that's where the real human being behind the chemical haze of meth addiction and youth has emerged. And that human being may have actually had more value than we give him credit for, or she, in the occasion of killing him." Mike, how do you fix the problems associated with capital punishment?
You don't kill people. And by the way, by the state's own word, they murder them. That's what the death certificate says, murder.
I think it says homicide.
It says
homicide, not murder.
Yes, homicide is the cause of death.
But
I guess I'm wrong.
In terms of the facts of this case, Marlo,
it's
the manner and means of death, as alleged in the indictment, was by manual strangulation and ligature strangulation with an object, the exact nature of which is unknown, and by blunt force injury resulting in an impact with a blunt object. So the indictment allowed for alternate means of death, because there was some evidence that the autopsy showed that she'd been strangled. But did the strangulation result in the death? There was also blunt force. When Acker drove away from the house with her in the truck. The witnesses there said, you know, he was driving like a pretty fast, running in the ditches and so forth. And even he claims that there was he testified at trial.
On his own behalf?
On his own behalf. Said initially he wasn't going to testify, but then he does go and testify. And he says that what happened was she jumped out of the truck, and that's what caused the death. And there was then the battle of the experts in terms of what caused the death. Could it have been the strangulation? Because the death occurred somewhere near the time of strangulation. And the conclusion seemed to have been that either one alone could have caused the death. There was also some testimony sought to be admitted at trial. One of her acquaintances, one of the acquaintances of the deceased, of Marquette, Marky, George, said that Marky, 2 weeks ago, she and Ackard got into an argument, and Marky says, I tried to jump out of the truck, and he pulled me back in. But that evidence was not admitted at trial. Okay, now we don't just in this country, we do have, you know, the trial and then the appeal, and then the automatic appeal in Texas. And then we've got the collateral remedies, that is the habeas corpus, both in the state level and the federal level. And one of the habeas proceedings, they actually, the issue of actual innocence was raised. Said, I didn't do it. And so they did hold a hearing and took witness testimony. Okay. At one of the habeas proceedings, and the friend was allowed to testify at habeas, saying that she did tell me that she tried to jump out of the truck, and that her face was close to the pavement, and Acker pulled me back in. Also at the same habeas hearing, the testimony was permitted to be used, permitted into evidence by a defense investigator, who said that, you know, he drove a truck very much like Acker's truck, and he could not open the door from the driver's side. So they were trying to support Acker's statement, his defense. But by this time at the habeas level, it's not a matter of they're not trying to decide guilt or innocence. They're trying to determine whether there was an injustice served. That is, is this a case of actual innocence? And they couldn't get there, even with that additional testimony. Now, would it have made a difference at trial? I don't know. These witnesses did testify outside the presence of the jury as to what their testimony would be, but the judge didn't let it in.
I want to know, does anyone in this room believe that we have put an innocent man to death? This is Jackie.
I won't actually say definitively. There have been instances in the past where I've thought that we did put to death somebody who was innocent. In this case, I think there is some question, but let me give you some thoughts as to the appellate process. The appellate courts are very reluctant to overturn jury decisions. So if a jury says guilty, an appellate court is very unlikely to say, well, we think you're wrong, that in fact it was guilty, this person was innocent. And then once a jury says, well, we find future dangerousness dangerousness and there insufficient mitigation evidence, then we're and assess, and by law that means, you know, if there not enough mitigation evidence and there's future and they find future dangerousness, then it's automatic sentencing of death. Appellate courts are reluctant to overturn either the guilt or the sentence, and
why?
It's appellate courts are not meant to second guess for lack of better words, the common sense of 12 people on the jury. That's the idea. And, you know, an appellate court will come out and say, okay, you got this wrong because you didn't do this procedure and it would or would not have changed the result. Or we think you did this wrong, and because we think it might have changed the result, go back and retry the case. They will do that. But they're real reluctant to say, you know, jury, we think you got it wrong. We're gonna overturn it.
Yeah, that is generally not an issue on appeal.
Right. In this case, I think, there is the very at least what I read, it seems to me that there may be an issue as to actual innocence. That maybe she did jump out of the truck. I used to drive a F-350 of that generation. And I can tell you, there was no way I could hold on to the steering wheel, look over the dashboard, and open the door at the same time. And, you know, granted, I'm not the largest person in the world.
But it's a wide
but
body.
It's very wide.
Yeah.
I can lie in the back seat. I can actually lie in the front or the back because my front was a bench, just like in the evidence.
In this case.
Yeah, in this case, yeah. Without, you know, perfectly flat, feet, head, not touching either door. And it's a really wide car. Trying to push somebody out of that truck, I think that'd be difficult. There was some expert testimony later that after the trial that, you know, the injuries that George suffered was not consistent with strangulation, that it was in fact her head was bashed in, her brain was crushed,
her liver was shredded.
Shredded, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, these are things that are inconsistent with simple. I mean, you really have to be beating somebody up for a long time to do that, or running over or falling out of a moving vehicle. That could do it pretty quickly.
So assume she got run over. Wouldn't those injuries be evidence on the car that ran her over?
But here's the issue. This evidence came out in the appellate process. And because this evidence came out in the appellate process, and the appellate court is reluctant to overturn a jury conviction.
Didn't the appellate court also, the state witness says there was no strangulation?
The state
witness and at the
appellate level.
Okay.
And again, an appellate court is reluctant to overturn a jury conviction.
Our procedures are designed to protect us. But when it comes to death penalty, the procedures killed him.
No.
They said procedurally he could not say his say because the procedure says it's wrong.
Does anyone have a Xanax for him?
I think he's doing right. Please keep talking, Mike.
The procedures are designed
to protect people.
To protect people.
To justice.
At guilt or innocence, and to protect the rights of defendants. The procedures are designed to guarantee the credibility of the conviction after has happened.
Right.
But when the state witness says opposite to the theory of the case, they can't say, oh, procedurally, you can't bring it up.
There were three different theories of the case.
It's all procedural. Three different theories. They didn't know how she was killed. They didn't know when she was killed. All they knew is she was killed. And I'm saying it's a premeditated murder. He should get life in prison. But we just kill somebody based upon somebody decided to kill him based upon the theory of kidnapping and abduction that the jury has no idea what they mean. At the minimum, there should be a finding there was an abduction, a finding there was a kidnapping, but there wasn't.
Except that there was a witness who saw her being thrown over Acker's shoulders, taken into a truck, and as if in much the same way that a cat was being thrown into a bathtub.
But that is not an abduction. By definition, abduction is a secret of somebody so they can't be found. That's not secret in her.
That may be the definition, but let's does anybody here think that if that woman, when that woman went into the truck, that she was going to come out alive?
That's not, but we're not talking about it. We're talking
Texas
about
Penal Code
abducting
20.01.
Compared to kidnapping. Is kidnapping is a different crime than just, look, we're talking about killing a man. We can't, hey guys, if this is what the government wants to do to our citizens, so be it.
You are listening to a very lively discussion here on Execution Watch tonight. You are listening to KPFT 90.1 FM 89.7 in Huntsville. I am here with a panel with Mike Gillespie, with Paige Yannick, with Jack Lee, and Larry Douglas. And it looks like Larry Douglas has pulled over the microphone. So, Larry?
Just want to talk a few minutes about the system, our criminal justice system. Particularly as it relates to all criminal cases, including death penalties. We have a constitutional right to a trial by jury. Don't have a constitutional right to an appeal. Don't have a constitutional right to the various collateral proceedings that we go through. And Acker went through the whole set of procedures. He got a trial. And he got an appeal. And there were several several collateral four is what paid. Well, he had the court did determine that he had actually abused the system in terms of filing successive writs. Okay, including a writ saying.
Tell me what that means.
Writ, you want to talk about that, Paige?
Okay. I'll let you, but basically it starts out like this. There is a direct appeal to the Court of Criminal Appeals after a jury has found someone guilty of capital murder. So the Court of Criminal Appeals fully briefs the case and does an appeal.
And that's automatic on a capital.
Then there are writs of habeas corpus. There's something wrong with how we got here. And that's what a habeas corpus is all about. We must have the body. And that's the direct translation of habeas corpus. In any event, there were, I believe, four different habeas petitions. It started out at the state court level with the state habeas. Then, Larry, you take it from there.
Well, I think in the very end that Acker actually filed his own habeas, was found to be successive writ. And I think it was like a 232-page writ of habeas corpus. The primary issue he raised was actual innocence, which requires a showing that he actually did not commit the offense. Now that's one that trumps everything. Okay, actual innocence is going to be considered, and if there are facts that suggest that show by preponderance of the evidence that the person is actually innocent, that is, he could not have done it. DNA evidence shows he could not have done it. A credible person comes forward and says, I committed the crime, and the story checks out. That's actual innocence. Okay? And so, but actual innocence means exactly what it says. Not that it's an arguable case that perhaps if I went back, the thing is that you've got the trial, proceeding. Then the appellate proceeding, is to find out whether a superior court looks at the full record to determine whether there were any errors in the trial court proceeding. If there were errors, then they can be either, if they were significant errors, they might result in the court case being overturned. And it can go back to it can be changed as a result of errors on appeal. The writ process going to the state court, they're looking to see whether the results offend the law. That is, this is so far out of the application of Texas law that this finding is offensive to the law. That's and for the state writ proceeding, habeas proceeding. That's the matter of, does this offend Texas law? And the same is true for the federal writ. Does it offend Texas law? That's primarily what it's looking for. Is it a manifest violation of the law? Not getting into the facts of the case, but finding out an actual innocence is one of those things that if an actually innocent person is found guilty, and this has nothing, this does not necessarily apply just to capital cases, but actual innocence of any case. If there is something that overwhelmingly shows that you can show up, you can bring this up at any time. It shows that I could not have committed the crime at all. I mean, I've got pictures of me being someplace else, and it clearly shows that I wasn't even there.
But meanwhile, I mean, are we caught in a situation now where our current Texas law, these other people who were actually condemned before 2005, are they just kind of caught in a catch-22 situation? I mean, has law
because there was no option?
Yes. Yes.
I don't really know whether or not to have an opinion on that. I mean, the law evolves to deal with the facts that society presents. And society presented the possibility of life without parole. And we had gone through the 80s over such a long period of time when there was no capital murder as a result of the Supreme Court, and the entire capital
right.
system was revamped. And then in 2005, they instituted life without parole as an option. I mean, I've watched part of this happen, but I can't really tell you, I really can't have an opinion about it. I would rather say that I appreciate the fact pattern that could support life without parole. I appreciate the fact pattern that could call for execution. And I appreciate a fact pattern where somebody is not guilty beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right. You know, I have to mention, of course, something that Linda brought up when she was standing there in the only cool weather we've actually had for a while outside of Huntsville in the death, outside of the death house. And that is that so many of our activists are, let's just say, old. There, we don't have young people who are interested in changing the capital punishment. They don't understand, or else they're not coming out and saying anything about this. Has this whole process just become too complex?
No, they're posting up on social media and sending thoughts and prayers, and they're doing something.
Are thoughts and prayers doing anything?
Not to me.
Mm-hmm.
And very little to the legislator.
But their thoughts and prayers, and they feel good about it.
Have all of you been involved in capital punishment cases before?
We have. I have not.
Mm-hmm.
I've had two cases just like this where the question is, did the woman jump out of the moving car and get killed, or did he push her out of the moving car and get killed? So I've had two cases with these issues. But nobody was even arrested in those cases.
Really?
One of the cases, we know the boyfriend beat her just like this. We knew it. But she didn't die. She was on life support. She was pregnant. They kept her alive for the baby's sake. We in the family wanted to pull the plug so in the autopsy we can prove the internal injuries. And we had to go to court on the right to life people and the fundamental Christians on the concept of losing a baby so we could never get that guy arrested. I've had two cases just like that, and they weren't even arrested, and this guy's been murdered for it.
Very interesting.
Not that I don't think this was not premeditated, but one of my cases is identical. It's the boyfriend and the husband, and the boyfriend throws her out of the car in some traffic. She got run over. But he wasn't even arrested. So what's the difference between a death penalty and freedom? The DA?
The venue?
Yeah, the county.
That could do it.
It sounds like half of the county was there actually testifying.
Well, does all this sound right? That depends on where you do it. Depends on the... Now, if you're talking about going to jail, local customs become important. But this is homicide. And by the way, do we realize that the Pope has come out and said that we shouldn't be doing this? Mm. Now...
Well, I want to thank everybody right now. The time is 18:56. We're going to wrap it up here tonight. I'd like to thank our panel, Larry B. Douglas, Jack Lee, Mike Gillespie, and Paige Yannick, Death House reporter Linda Huhan, executive producer Elizabeth Stein, and our engineer Bob Gartner for their assistance on today's program. Coming up next is the Progressive Forum with Wally James. Now, on behalf of your regular host, Ray Hill, who we send our best wishes to, I'm Marlo Blue. Good night.